This is an RSA podcast. RDI Insights. Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
I've come to Wapping in the heart of London's Dockland. I'm here at the Times newspaper to meet one of the country's most respected political cartoonists. Peter Brooks has been wielding his caustic nib at the Times for the past two decades. Every weekday, he creates a piece of cartoon history that entertains and infuriates in equal measures. Indeed, on the day I arrived, he was getting a stream of angry emails complaining about his depiction of the Pope holding a packet of condoms with the caption, "World Food Crisis Summit Rome, One Solution." Clearly to Brooks, nothing is sacred. Our conversation took place in his minuscule and noisy office tucked away at the back of the design department, shortly after the paper had gone to bed with yet another of Brooks's creations gracing its pages. What I'd like to start with is a description of where we are, because normally these interviews have taken place in people's houses. But I've come here today because you have this particular working pattern, which means you're still at work as we are at 7:30 at night, which is your regular day. So I'm in this little triangular office, which is literally covered in paper and books and clutter, and what is really a traditional illustrator's desk with a slightly raked table and pen and inks. And I don't think this has probably changed for any political cartoonist for probably a century. You know, there's no sign of a computer apart from obviously your email. So I think that's setting the scene. But what I'd like to do is to go back a little bit, because I was interested to discover that your father was in the RAF, and obviously normally in these interviews I try to find out whether there was a really creative influence within the family. But in your case, your father was in the RAF, and that led you into the RAF. And so was that a natural...
That's true. That was more a sort of destructive influence, I should think, going into the RAF, as opposed to a creative influence. Was that a natural...
Well, was it... I mean, was it... Obviously, having the RAF around you and people that I know that have been in the services or in a service family, they move around.
That's precisely it. I must have gone to about a dozen schools, all told, until my parents then went abroad and I had to go to boarding school. But, yeah, the whole point of service life was very much, you know, drilled into me in the sense of moving around with them.
Yeah.
Apart from when I went to boarding school. You know, I thought that's what I wanted to do. He was in the RAF, he wasn't a pilot, but I thought I wanted to be a pilot, which was a desperately stupid mistake to have made.
Yeah.
But then I was young.
Yeah. And you would have joined up, presumably, because you were not of National Service.
No, I was after National Service. Yeah. This was in about...
When 62, was I think.
Oh, right, yeah, okay, yes. I went to Cranmore, which is the sort of Sandhurst of the RAF, to train to be a pilot, and I got thrown out about 2.5 years after getting
time.
There. Yeah, I went through, I was 6 months off, actually, getting there, but I'm really glad to say that they saw the light and parted company with me, because it was going to be either an incredibly expensive, you know, mess.
So did you ever get to fly?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you did?
So oh,
you
yeah,
did
yeah. I flew solo in the lot, you know. And the irony is, I'd do anything to avoid flying now. I mean, flying as a passenger.
Yeah.
Absolutely loathe it.
Yes.
Hate it. But at the time, I mean... I was totally unsuited to it, really, because I was the only person in this place who couldn't drive a car. But I could fly. In fact, I could fly solo jets.
Really?
Before,
jets?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
He went from chipmunks
onto,
which are single propeller things, onto Jet Provis.
Right.
I could do all that before I could drive a car. I didn't learn to drive a car until I was thrown out, and after I went back home. It was a wrong turning, put it that
but
way.
But you, I think towards the end, did you not, you started to study for
at London University.
Yeah, I did a degree.
You did a degree in
English. I did a degree in English and economics and war studies, of all things, which is part of their setup.
And was that just, that was part of
that was, I had to do that aside from what I was doing in terms of flying and all the rest of it.
But were you at that time, I mean, during that whole period of when you were, you know, the young Peter Brooks and the influence of your father and moving around all the time, were you illustrating, drawing?
Yeah.
Do you have a natural ability?
Yeah,
you're sketching?
Yeah, I did. The school I was at, for example, didn't have the sort of teaching to do art at A level. And they didn't encourage art in any sense, really. They did GC... What would it be?
I think it was
GCE.
Yeah,
I nearly said
General Certificate of
Education. Yeah, GCE then. to O level, anyway. And I took that early because they want, you know, if you could do Latin, that's what you were supposed to do.
Yeah.
So I took it early, about 13 or something like that.
Yeah.
And I'd always been keen on drawing. And used to do cartoons in the school magazine, all that sort of thing.
Ah.
And then when I was in the RAF, I was the one who was sort of dragged in to do stage sets for.
Yes, I was going to ask
things.
You about that.
Yeah.
The stage
and
set.
Again, illustrating the college magazine with cartoons and drawings. So I did all that, but I never really considered it to be, you know, a career. But that was what was great about being thrown out, because.
Yes.
In the, you know, process of that, I had to continue with my degree and finish that off over the 3 years, which was fine. But then I was just absolutely determined I was going to go to
So you
art
went
college.
For a foundation course?
Yeah,
in
Manchester.
Is that where you found
a
direction?
Yeah, it was absolutely wonderful. Absolutely terrific.
And then you moved down to
Central,
in 66.
Yeah.
And I think you described it, as a liberation.
Yeah, very much.
After
so.
the RAF. Yeah. I suppose simply the people you were with, you know, the different.
Well, I actually enjoyed being with the people I was with in the RAF, actually. I did. I mean, I made some very good friends who, you know, have actually still kept in touch in a minor way. I mean, I don't really see them. But it was a liberation in the sense that, you know, really, first of all, it was a huge weight lifted off my shoulder from, you know, stopping flying, because I was useless at it.
Yeah.
And I knew my life wasn't in the forces, and it was a stupid, it was a genuine mistake like you make early on. And luckily enough, I wasn't there long enough it not to be corrected. So, you know, I was only 3 years too old. Not 3 years too old, but 3 years older than other people. But I just happened to be in a year that had quite a lot of older students in.
Yeah,
actually.
I mean, I think Posy Simmons.
Yeah, Posy, she was in the year above me.
Yes. And I think at that time, I don't know what it's like now, obviously it's changed so much, but Central at that time in the 60s encouraged their students to take on freelance.
They do.
Out of kind of curricular activity.
Yes, they do.
And you started to produce some illustrations and various bits and bobs.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think you were, I think some of those projects we worked on, you were doing cartoons for magazines, and you did a little bit of work for New Society.
Yeah.
And you worked, I read, as an apprentice to a graphic designer called Brian Boyle. Now,
that's right.
Did you really serve as an apprentice with you?
Apprentice, yeah. I mean, in a real sense it was, because he took me straight from art college. He came in and gave us a couple of projects, and so he knew a few of us to give us work and all the rest of it. And then when I left, I went to work with him in Great Portland Street.
So what were you doing?
Great.
What sort of
book jackets? And
you were doing book.
Either illustrated or designed, because I did a graphic design course.
Yeah, exactly.
I wasn't an illustrator as such, although I liked drawing, and but I, through him, got to do quite a lot of illustrative work. And at the same time, although he paid me, and in the end he said, look, you're doing enough of your own stuff, why don't you pay studio rent and all the rest of it, and be freelanced, and I'll give a certain amount of work and all the rest of it.
So you kind of share the space.
Which is what I did before doing exactly the same with Time Out and Piers Marchbank.
Of course, yes.
And I did the same there. I rented studio space and did, I don't know, 3 or 4 drawings a week for them or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Time Out period in connection with Piers Marchbank saw a kind of blossoming of your work, particularly covers.
That's right.
A lot of covers. You did a lot of covers, and they were, you know, it seemed to be there was a, you were going towards a natural course, which I think we end up with later. But so with Piers Marchbank, who I've also spoken to actually, that was a terrific period when that magazine was really firing.
That was mostly down to Piers anyway. And I was at college with him. He was a big mate of mine at college, you see.
Right, okay.
We used to sit right next to each other.
Yeah.
And although I drew and he didn't,
yeah,
we both had the same sort of... We both appreciated each other's ideas.
Yeah.
We both thought in the same type of way.
I think you're both in that conceptual
way. Yeah, thinking, exactly.
You know, exactly. Which is where good graphic designers come from.
Yeah, yeah. You know? And what I'm... I don't know why, but what I'm delighted about, really, in terms of looking back and, you know, so long from now, was that my thinking then is actually no different from my thinking now in terms of coming up with ideas. The ideas are different and they're targeted in a different way, but the process is exactly the same. And there's some sort of strange satisfaction in that. I don't know why.
I agree.
But Piers was very much on the same sort of level of sort of working out ideas.
Yes.
And so when I worked with him at Time Out, I mean, he commissioned, you know, he was the designer. He was the one who made Time Out what it still is now,
absolutely.
Amazingly. As far as I know, I haven't seen it for a little while. Same logo,
that's about it. I think that, sadly, you know, that magazine, along with many magazines, just not... They're just information magazines now.
Yeah.
They don't have that political side, which was very powerful.
But it was... except Time Out, even then, wasn't the most political of things. Put it this way, it was a great sort of breath of fresh air from something like What's On in London, which was the earlier listings magazine.
Well, I remember, of course, the whole period where they had equality of salaries
including
front desk, and then there was a kind of a walkout.
Yes, that's right.
And then City Limits started.
City Limits, yes, indeed.
Dave King, of course,
the
other graphic designer who's a particular panache constructivist kind of typography, and that was very... And so there were these parallel magazines running side by side, and then another one came into the fray, which I think was Richard Branson's magazine.
Exactly.
Which I think took Piers away.
Yeah, he did.
To do that.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting time.
Yeah. I always remember getting a phone call. I mean, what a strange thing is, this man in this position now phoned me up to do a cover once. I seem to remember he was in that sort of role of just, you know, having done this magazine called Student, I think it was, Richard Branson, was then, you know, at the beginning of his sort of entrepreneurial thing, you know, building up a sort of empire of magazines. I don't think he ever did. I don't think anything
was the magazine he produced with
Piers
as art director, but it was short-lived.
Yes, it was.
It was good-looking.
And then he moved on to something else. Yeah. No, the great thing about Piers and Time Out was just how wonderfully well he found a way of designing something.
But then, you know, following that, I think you continued with a steady flow of freelance work, but then you got very involved with Radio Times.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
and I think Radio Times, looking at that body of work, is, for me, a fantastic array of work, because it really does demonstrate your abilities as an illustrator. And not only the ability to illustrate it, but the various techniques you used. I mean, you had this very tight, almost steel engraving effect that perfected.
Yeah.
But then you could switch to very, very tight gouache colour work, that's which right. is just...
But it used to worry me desperately, all of that, because I never knew quite what I was. You know, I was doing one thing one way and another thing another way. I used to do a lot of pastiches of things,
yes.
which seemed to be, I don't know, an excuse for not being yourself, really. It took a while to sort out a way of working that you...
Sure, I think what, regardless of the varying styles and maybe the experimentation, trying to find yourself, what comes through in all of that work is the sheer thinking, the
yeah,
ideas
the ideas
shining through. And they're dressed up in different sort of yeah, guises, but this, yeah. the ideas are very, very strong.
Yeah, that's always been the important thing for me. I mean, there's been no joy in just drawing for drawing's sake in my career, but there has been every sort of joy in just sort of that. And strangely enough, I mean, my son, who's 27 and works for a city firm, is a mathematician.
Yeah.
And to him, what he does, the work he does, is exactly the same. It's solving problems.
Of course.
It's coming up with a solution to something.
Yeah.
And although, I suppose that's really the way I always set it. You know, it had to be, I had to come up with, you know, you worry about
yeah.
how to approach something and what to do. You know, it had to have the right element of humour or the right sort of element of wit or whatever for it to work. But it had to be an idea,
yeah.
and I couldn't just do a drawing.
No. Yeah. Well, I think it was at the Radio Times that you had this regular little weekly column called Brooks On.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it was mostly on, a comment on broadcasting or...
Yes, that's it.
And I think you'd sit down with the editor and so forth and talk through issues and
yeah.
so you were beginning to get into the realms of what you do now
commenting
and being witty and
I'm from that sort of work. Oh, I don't want to jump your particular
I think that period really sort of demonstrated just you know what you were capable of, and you then went. You know, in 76, after I think Nicholas Garlin left, you took over the political cartoon spot for the New Statesman. But it was very
it wasn't quite like that. He just went away for a long holiday.
Oh, he went because
and
because I read that you so you didn't. Leave after 6 weeks.
Yeah, well, that's, you've got more. Or, it's more or less the same, actually. What happened was I was just doing. I was just a holiday stand-in over, you know, July and August,
yeah.
whatever. So, you know, 6 or whatever it was weeks. And Tony Howard was the editor then. Nick Garlin had seen what I'd done in Sunday Times and newspapers and things, because I was doing these sort of comment type illustrations that went with articles. Business News, Sunday Times, various, you know, sort of op-ed pages for magazine or newspapers. And Garland had seen these and recommended to Tony Howard that he used to take terribly long holidays, and Tony Howard used to get incredibly pissed off about this because he had to manage a space which was quite big, which was empty in the New Statesman while he was away, and I did it, but I didn't think it was my sort of thing at all, really. I can remember doing the drawings and sort of thinking, oh, yeah, but approaching them in exactly the same way as I approached drawing for Radio Times or something, which isn't the way you should look at politics at all, you know. It's not a radio play, politics.
No. Well, it kind of is a bit of a saga.
It might be a saga.
Certainly recently. A little later, a slot became available at the Times, and I think Harold Evans was the
editor at the time,
and you were invited again to... but you said you felt uncomfortable, and you didn't go on to...
Oh, no, I didn't feel... What happened there, I used to do a lot of alongside all the Radio Times stuff and all that stuff in about 1970-odd and a bit later... I was doing sort of headings for Jeanette Collins on the Times.
Oh, yes.
Strange things that went on the top page ads for cars and or homes or gardening implements and that sort of thing. And I'd do these long sort of page-width decorated headings for them. And so I started working for the Times that way. And when Harold Evans was editor, I started doing illustrations on the Times pages as well. And shortly after that, David Driver was made up as head of design.
I remember, yeah.
And he, being on the Radio Times,
yes,
knowing that I did that sort of work as well,
yeah,
wanted me in there on a more regular basis. Harry Evans was given the boot, famously, as
yes,
we know,
I remember,
after
yes,
a year.
Yes.
And then Charlie Douglas Hume took over as editor. And they already had a cartoonist called Renan Lurie,
mm-hmm,
who was a political cartoonist, but an international one, really. He was Israeli-American. And he was someone who really produced cartoons about the international political scene and not about the domestic. He tried it, mixing the domestic thing, but he wasn't suited in any country that he worked in. He went around the world working just about every newspaper that there is. His claim to fame was always as the most syndicated cartoonist ever. Anyway, he didn't spend a huge amount of time at the Times before moving on, and they needed to fill the spot, and or wanted to, and they offered to, you know, let me have a try, which I did. And again, the same thing happened with the Times as happened with the New Statesman. I mean, I thought I could do it, wanted to do it, but had absolutely no confidence in my ability to do it.
Absolutely. So how did that manifest itself? Were you just unhappy with the results, or did you panic?
What happened was...
Was it just a loss of...
Well, what happened was, the worst thing, in a sense, was that I was offered the chance to do it alongside the other illustrations that I was doing. In other words, during any given week, I did two or three drawings that went with articles by Bernard Levin, say, or Simon Jenkins later, people like that, anyway, commentators. And they were always political articles. But then I was asked to do two or three cartoons, you see, which is a totally different thing,
yeah,
totally different animal. Most people don't quite know that that's the case, you know, when they're looking at a paper, but it is. It's a freestanding, you know, your own comment and all the rest of it. And you've got to have something to say.
Yeah.
And what I found was because I was new to it, if the day was really difficult or I just couldn't think of anything to do, I'd sort of scurry back to doing an illustration for, you know, the op-ed page.
Was that a kind of a comfort blanket?
Yeah, because I could do that. Yeah. I knew what I was doing, and, you know, you didn't have to come up with... Well, you have to come up with your own idea,
yeah,
but your own idea was based on somebody else's thought process in the first place.
Yeah.
So all you were doing was finding a way of literally illustrating, illuminating their message.
So you kind of just pottered along then after that.
Yeah, well,
I
copped out again.
And
yeah,
you just
yeah,
carried on.
Much
doing...
to the dismay of the then editor, Charlie Douglas Hume, sadly died, and very young. He was only in his early 40s, and Charlie Wilson took over. And Charlie Wilson was a great guy. I liked and like him enormously. He was rough and ready Glaswegian, and he's famous in the newspaper world as being Gorbals Wilson, and had a very, very rough tongue. But he was terrific, absolutely terrific. And he was very keen on having a cartoon. He was very keen that I should continue. And he was very, very pissed off with me when I just threw in the towel, rather pathetically. I thought, again, it was like stopping flying. You know, the world, the weight of all this was lifted off my shoulders, and I could get back doing something that I knew I could do, which was illustration.
So then what later, I think 92, made you, the third time, decide to take the...
Because I take failure very, very hard, frankly, and the knowledge that there was something that I was interested in, because I've always been interested, not actively politically, but I've always, since I was doing, that's why one drifts in a certain sort of way towards the type of work that you do, that you, I like commenting, I like sort of Well, I liked then doing the, even though it was attached to somebody else's initial thinking. I mean, I always sort of managed to get my own sort of way of looking at things in there, really. I didn't slavishly follow. I followed the drift of what they were saying, but after a while, you do get very, very, very fed up of just doing that to somebody else's tune, you know, dancing to somebody else's tune. I didn't really like that. And I mean, bless his little cotton socks or whatever you say, but Bernard Levin had a wonderful, wonderful economist, though he was. He did, from my point of view, have about five themes that he rattled on about. Mm. And a lot of them I was, you know, sort of so familiar with, and trying to get the same sort of message across, but in a different way each time, was pretty tricky. And I really got to the point of thinking, you know, this isn't really what I want to spend the rest of my life doing. And although I channeled myself into that comment slot, basically, I still felt I really wanted to say things, you know, from my own point of view.
So what finally made you say yes
that was quite easy, because what happened was Simon Jenkins became editor after Charlie Wilson. I went to him and I said, is there any chance at all, you know, I could be cartoonist rather than just an illustrator? And he said, well, he hummed and ahed and said, well, we'll give it a try. And he said, if you come to me every day with half a dozen ideas on the day's news, but continue doing what you're doing, you know, we'll see how it goes. Well, that was just a ball breaker, basically, yeah. Or balls breaker, whatever.
Half a dozen
ideas. Yeah, well, I didn't know in the end, that got whittled down to about three or four, but I think he rather lost interest and wasn't too fussed. You know, whether he didn't say, oh great, you know, carry on and do it, and I lost interest until he was only editor for a short while, and then Peter Stoddart became editor.
Yeah,
and I'd worked with, he was features editor, went over to the States, came back as editor, and I'd worked for him. He knew what I could or couldn't do, and knew that, you know, I wanted to try to be a cartoonist again, and offered me the spot, you know, doing it. But this time I didn't have the fail-safe of going back to doing other drawings. I just did five a week, and that was it.
So that was the beginning of you kind of cutting back on, well, or rather turning your back on all the other... To concentrate on finding a style.
Oh, yeah, I did, yeah, exactly.
Because,
yeah.
I mean, obviously the pressure of a daily cartoon means you've got to become much more economical in your... You can no longer go down the routes that you used to go down, which were far more... I mean, I know that you'd always been, you've been very free in a lot of your illustrations, but you seem to have pared it right down now to a simplicity that, although it's all in colour, which is quite remarkable, because many political cartoonists are, you know, were mostly black and white.
Yeah,
so that was kind of an unusual thing, an added,
You
know, it's sort of simplifying your drawing, but adding back into it.
That's right,
the colour work.
Yeah, I was sort of very loath to adopt the colour mantle, basically. Because I've always thought that a political comment can be made, it's at its simplest, in black and white.
Sure.
And, you know, history always allowed that, apart from, you know, good, you know, Gilray's and all the rest, which were highly coloured.
Absolutely, yeah.
So it's a nonsense to think they were always like that. But it had developed that way, you know, over many years, and the big famous cartoonists like Lowe, Vicky, all worked purely in black and white.
Well,
and
I suppose the printing techniques were a lot
cruder
anyway.
Well, you didn't have colour.
We were talking about 65 dot screen for half tone, so that was pretty awful.
Oh, yes, yes.
So black and white really...
But black and white line sort of really gave things a sort of, you know, and if you're trying to get an idea across in some sort of really sombre graphic way, black and white was the thing that did it, and dressing things up in colour, I always thought, was, you know, a bit of a nonsense, and but the two things stopped me thinking that. or three really, I suppose. One, I never felt that confident using colour, but after a while doing it, I felt a little bit more confident and less uneasy about it. So from a practical point of view, I got over that. But also someone said to me, you know, as a counter-argument to the fact that, you know, the Lowe's and the Vickies and the Illingworths all work wonderfully in black and white, was that, you know, if colour had been available to them, do you think they wouldn't have used it? And of course they would.
And of course they did use
tone. They did
tone.
It to a degree, they did, yeah. They used tone. They used tone.
Because obviously, clearly, they wanted to get a bit more dimension.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm sure you're
and
right.
And Lowe did do quite a number of colour things for various magazines. Things
yes.
Like that. So when it was available, I'm sure they would have used it. And, you know, I just felt, you know, in the end, that the other argument being, of course, that actually you're talking to me in the week that we've actually gone, well, it's been redesigned this week to accommodate the fact that we've got full colour on every page. So now if you do a black and white thing, it certainly looks slightly out of place and doesn't look quite right. And let's face it, I mean, I suppose eventually black and white work in newspapers and magazines will look as outdated as black and white televisions do. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, that's debatable, I think. I think that, you know, looking at newspapers, I mean, we're veering off the subject, but it's very much your world, so
yeah.
I think it's, and you're very much a graphic designer, but my, you know, in recent, I follow newspaper design, you know, out of personal interest, and watched it, and of course watched, you know, modern technologies transform, you know, the quality of printing and what can be done and so forth, and also, you know, very aware of what the web has done to newspapers in terms of they have a presence on the web, which you can now, you know, graze through your daily papers on the web of each newspaper around the world.
Yeah.
And my feeling with many newspapers now is that they're literally trying to visually replicate what's being seen on the web. So there are more boxes, more bars, more this, more that, more colour. It's piling in too much. And when I do see some of the New York papers or some of the Swiss papers, they're very quiet.
Right.
And it's a real breath of fresh air. I find it's like they're not shouting. I think there's a little too much shouting. I mean, I think all of the original broadsheets have moved towards, you know, a middle ground. I don't see as much differentiation now. Even the new Guardian.
Yeah.
It doesn't really do it for me. I think it's, you know, it's very well put together, but I just find there's a sort of blandness. And there are a lot of these international newspaper designers that literally go around applying a style around the world. South America 1 week, you know, Spain the next.
Oh, sure they do.
They're in London doing the Independent, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And they all end up looking rather similar.
Yeah, except ours hasn't been put together by
people from the Times is
anywhere else.
I mean, apart from obviously going down to, you know, moving from broadsheet down to a compact size, it still very much has its, you know, integrity, typographic integrity. And I guess that's because David Driver is still very much.
Although he hasn't been, he hasn't been very involved in the new setup that we've had this week. I think we're not a million miles away from the Guardian, actually, in the general look of things and the way that we use colour.
Mm.
I don't share your opinion on that.
No,
I mean, newspapers. I mean, I find French newspapers incredibly boring. And I would think probably Swiss newspapers, if I knew any. Certainly a few German papers. I used to love Die Zeit. When I was in Illustrated, Die Zeit to me was, I used to go and get it, not knowing a word of German. I'd get it every week. And they were great on the way they used illustrations and drawings, newspaper drawings. They were fantastic. And I would really, there were one or two particular illustrators that were just geniuses, I thought. That was a pretty, I don't know what it's like now, actually. I haven't seen it for years. But it was all them, very sort of wide columns and a very large newspaper.
Yeah.
Plenty of white space.
A lot of white space, which is really unheard of.
Yes, that's right. Not anymore, it's not unheard of, because our Times 2 is full of white space.
Oh.
And yesterday got an absolute hammering from a critic in the Standard, Roy Greenslade, for it as well.
Too much white space.
Yeah.
What a pity.
But it's just one point of view, and be interesting to see how that...
You mentioned David Lowe just now,
yeah.
And I read an interesting thing, which I'm sure you know, but it just gives an indication of, I think, the influence and power of the political cartoonist. I mean, he apparently infuriated Hitler so much because he was forever drawing cartoons of Hitler in various guises, as donkeys and all sorts of things, that Hitler put pressure on the British government to get them stopped. And at that time, there was a government minister called Lord Halifax who visited Lowe in 1937 to ask him to tone down his work in the interest of peace. And Lowe did. He actually did tone these down until Hitler occupied Austria a few months later and went straight back again.
Yeah, quite right.
So I wanted to ask you about your feelings about the influence that... the political cartoonist can have, because sometimes I think that, I listen to Jeremy Paxman and John Humphreys when they're giving a politician a good grilling, and then I might, look at some of your work where you've been incredibly vicious to a politician, and I think, well, actually, that's far worse than, these guys can put up with, and they're trained to put up with a Paxman interview.
Yeah, yeah.
But having people laugh,
in
Parliament say, have you
is,
seen Brooks'
that,
cartoons?
That is laughing at them. I don't know about that, about what effect you have on politicians. To my mind, and the way I see it is that you probably have absolutely no effect on them at all, and in a sense... It's not them that you're getting at them, but you're also trying to influence, because you've got a readership, what people think. I mean, it's like having a debate or just having an argument with somebody.
Yeah.
And you're doing a drawing, and this is the way I see somebody on any given day.
Yeah.
And this is what I feel about something on any given day. And people react, sometimes well, sometimes furiously, and the furiously is better. And when they do, you hope that if someone's doing something you disapprove of, that you can, perhaps change people's voting intentions. It sounds terribly grand or terribly, but that seems to be the way it works to me more than, just make other people sort of say,
But, have you ever had any direct feedback from any of the people that you've depicted in your...
Oh, yeah, you do. But generally it's to my disadvantage rather than them saying, please don't do that again. They never say that. It's the old saw, really, of, if they're not depicted, they're far more upset than if they are.
Well, apparently politicians love buying them.
They do,
That's
they do
the place where they, they seem to...
Yeah, there is a lot of that. I sell through a gallery, so I don't do it direct. I'm happy to do that. I don't like dealing with that lot at all. They take notice of it. It was mainly their, people who, support them. I did a cartoon yesterday, which is not, it's political, but it was more, sort of religious based in the sense of reaction I got, which has been pretty horrendous over the last couple of days. Because I drew the Pope holding a condom packet. Because of the world hunger, the world food crisis summit in Rome, I decided to do one that just said one solution, and that's the Pope holding up. I did it. And it
oh my goodness!
It got a huge. And it's interesting. I'll explain the process of what happens when you're thinking of something which is going to be contentious in a moment. But it got a letter in today's paper, and here's the letter. And it says, I'll just read that first sentence. Sir, the political cartoon of Pope Benedict XVI, June 4th, was offensive and an oversimplification of complex issues. Well, that's exactly what a political cartoon should be.
It's amazing you've done this, because, you know, here is the head of the Catholic Church,
yeah,
and all that that represents.
Yeah.
And yet, it was only a couple of years ago that, you know, there was the famous Danish case of the cartoonist there. Yeah. Yeah. That brought that country onto the international stage.
It's interesting, because I didn't even think about this. When I did that, the how an idea comes is a mystery to me, and I've been doing it for 40 or whatever it is years. And it is a mystery. I mean, you set yourself a subject, knowing you whittle through what you want to say that particular day by, you know, the news you listen to in the morning and all the rest of it, and just gauging the subject you want to treat. But how you come up with the idea you want is, as I say, a mystery. But you don't come up with it by saying, I want to be outrageous as I possibly can.
No.
It doesn't work like that. No. You just got to find an angle or a way of saying something that you feel particularly strongly about. Or in this particular case, it's not obviously about world hunger, but it was just something must have clicked about the idea of Rome, and the idea that, well, if there are fewer people, I read that the population increase by 2015 was going to be something massive.
Yes.
I just thought, well, you know, doesn't it make sense to sort of control that? I mean, it is an oversimplification, because there's so many other things involved. But unfortunately, in a cartoon,
you have to be.
Not simplistic, but you have to be relatively simple in the way that you put a message across. And, yeah, a lot of people have said, who've complained about this, how dare you? I mean, this is one particular irate phone call this morning when I got in on the message thing, which said, how dare you do a cartoon like that? You would never contemplate doing an Islamic, a Muslim leader in that way. Well, actually, there was no need. I had no idea whether Muslims use condoms or not.
Yeah.
I do know that, you know, Catholics are told and taught not to.
Yeah.
And also, I don't know what any Muslim cleric necessarily looks like in terms of being recognisable to people in a cartoon. And you're not going to draw Muhammad doing that, because it's not... That's not the point. So people do get upset on that sort of basis.
Yes.
And why did you? Well, Rome had something to do with it.
Traditionally, when you feature a product in a television program or mention it on radio, you get a whole lot sent to you. I wonder whether Durex.
No, they wanted to buy it. Durex wanted to buy it. Yeah.
I just wanted you to just give me a glimpse of your daily routine, because I think that would fascinate people. That, you know, we're here in this very tiny office, which is your kind of engine room, where you're here for, for what? What's your daily routine?
Well, by the way, I mean, it's a tiny office, but I'm a lot luckier than most, because they all work
outside,
in open plan sort of spaces, everyone rushing past them and sort of using their PCs and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And at least I've got a window as well.
Yeah.
And this was built when we moved here, with me being able to, you know.
It has a fantastic view of varying shades of brick.
Yes, the view isn't the thing. I've got to admit. I mean, it's.
I think
it's got light.
For Docklands, you need to get your money back.
Yeah.
Don't see any docks. So what is your daily thing?
I wake up to the Today program at 6:30,
mm-hmm.
Very important to me. I listen to that for a couple of hours, leave round about 9, something like that. I'm only about a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes away on a good day. Mm-hmm. I get here, we have a morning conference at 10:30, and between waking and the morning conference, I'll have taken in, you know, the Today program, the agenda that they have every day, all the news that you can take in, you know, driving, listening to radio, reading the papers, not comprehensively, but pretty well, as much as I can, before the 10:30 conference, which gives me a sort of outline of what is likely to be in the paper that night. Obviously, during the course of the day, things change and things are updated, and I do that myself as well by just watching TV news, you know, going online, all that sort of thing. And it's just a process of getting as much information as you can until you realise you've probably got too much. Cut it down a bit just by starting to think up the ideas that you want to get across, and you sort of go from there, really. And by 2 or 3 o'clock, I've got to, in my own mind, be happy that I've got a, you know, I've got a sort of solution to, you know.
And so the agenda for the subject of the day is entirely yours, or
Yeah, but even, but that, although it is mine, in a strange way, it sort of is self-editing, because there are only certain things that. I mean, a political cartoon is a very odd animal, basically, because a lot of people, you know, who read the paper don't quite know how it works, you know. It's, they don't know, sometimes when you're being serious, I mean, you know, appallings happen that you don't want to make a joke about, or don't want to be witty about, or whatever, you just want to, you know, sort of say something quite somber or whatever. They think you're, because you're a cartoonist and it is a cartoon, they think you're trying to poke fun at it, for example. So there is that sort of thing you're always living with. But, you know, it's just a question really of whittling it down to 2 or 3 things that are going to be the subjects that people are on people's minds, or if they're not totally on people's minds, at least you can point them in the direction of the fact that these things have happened, and this is what your cartoon's about. And most importantly, really, it's something that you want to say.
Yeah.
Some days doesn't work quite as conveniently as that, because there are some days' news that you're repeating, you know, something that you, not literally repeating the whole idea, but repeating the subject, and maybe repeating what you feel about it. I mean, I get lambasted now and again for doing too many drawings of Gordon Brown, which is probably true.
It's very current at the moment.
Well, yeah, the difficulty I have now with Gordon Brown is, and not doing, I did get one remark that someone had added up the number of times I've drawn him in the last 3 months, and it rather horrified me. So I've actually literally, you know, taken that on board to the extent of saying, well, I'll try and limit myself in a different way, perhaps, because it can be boring for people.
Sure.
And also, it bores me if, you know, if I'm doing it to, the same happened with Tony Blair, but it's worse with Gordon Brown, because his cabinet is so anonymous, apart from 1 or 2 or 3, that when you're drawing them, you know,
people wouldn't recognise him.
No. And he's so dominant, or has been, and whether it'll continue that way is a moot point, but he has been so dominant that he's the only one. You know, he's the only one that you. Blair was to a degree, but then he had figures like Blunkett and you know, Charles Clarke and various others who were good to draw, great to draw. And now Ed Balls is awful to draw. The only good one apart from Brown himself, I suppose, is Miliband, who I'm beginning to enjoy drawing, but. People like Straw have been around for so long that, you know, it's sort of slightly second nature to draw them. But the likes of Jackie Smith, God, you know, such a boring politician. I mean, she's not too bad to draw, but, you know, there are a lot of nonentities in that cabinet.
Sure.
No great. James Purnell. Never drawn James Purnell. And everyone's talking about him as the possibility of being the next leader.
Well, I did hear that, yes.
Yeah.
I
mean, never drawn. No one would know.
There's a rather fantastic drawing of Boris Johnson right in front of us.
Oh, that was. Let me explain that.
My vision for London.
Yes.
And, he's got his hair over his eyes.
Completely over his eyes. Well, that one, I feel slightly angry about that. Or not so much angry as angry with myself, because it's a Spectator cover. Boris Johnson used to edit The Spectator.
Yes.
They wanted me to do the Boris Johnson for mayor in the week that he was going for mayor. the election. And I said, well, I will, but I don't want to endorse him. I don't want to do a drawing that endorses Boris, because I think he'd be a disastrous London mayor. And I just don't, I never, ever vote Conservative, and I don't want to, promote a Conservative. So I said, yeah, but I can't do it, I said, because it would mean that. And they said, no, you do your own thing. Honestly, we wouldn't be asking you to do it if we didn't want you to do your own thing. And I said, well, okay, but, you're not going to like it, because if you're supporting Boris, Anyway, their headline was, Vote for Boris, in huge, thick, and it killed off, even though the image was quite big. And it's interesting, it's so interesting. I thought, well, you can't have Vote for Boris, and then a picture of Boris with his hair completely covering his eyes saying, My vision for London. In other words, what you're saying is the guy hasn't got any clue at all or vision, and there you are telling. And they said, no, we like the idea that you can, And I've asked one or two people when it came out 3 or 4 weeks ago, whenever it was. Do you think this is a nonsense? It can't possibly work, can it? And they said, well, yeah, it does. In a strange way, it does. Sort of, there's a quirkiness to it.
Well, it certainly works very well by itself without the headline. It doesn't really need anything, does it, really?
Oh, no, but except they were wanted. That's what I'm saying. They were wanting to promote the man.
Yeah.
And I wasn't. And it was my own fault. I shouldn't have done it. I should have said no.
So just switching back for one moment to your daily routine. You finally get your idea.
Yeah.
And you're happy. And
so,
you produce a series of sort of sketches.
What happens is by 2 or 3 o'clock I sort of if I'm lucky it's earlier, and if I'm lucky it's a subject that isn't going to change for the rest of the day, something like Obama getting the Democratic thing, or you want to do that and that's not a problem. I filter it through thinking into one idea.
Yeah.
And I don't do several. I might just sketch out several ways of doing that idea, but it's all done in the thought process as to what I'm going to say. It's never sort of worked out on a layout pad or whatever.
Yeah.
But I do then draw it out, and it's always just the one thing.
The one idea. Yeah.
And then it takes me a couple of hours to do it. If I'm colouring the thing in by 5 o'clock, I'm out of my cake because I have to finish by 7. Then I take it down. I see the editor either earlier in the day. There's a new editor to us for the last 3 months.
Yeah.
He's very, very good to deal with. All the editors that I've had to take things along to show have been terrific, I have to say. All different. All quite different, but all just the right sort of temperament to understand what a cartoon's about and to react in the right way, or sometimes not, sometimes they liked what I did, and they didn't, but they always let me do it, that was the point. And I don't have anything written in the contract that says, like some people do, that says... you will always print his cartoon. Seems to me that any editor who can spike, any copy will certainly spike, if he decides he doesn't want it in, whatever your contract says, he won't put it in, Otherwise, he's not an editor, I think those are strange things that people draw up. I don't think they're very meaningful. Anyway, so I show him what I'm doing, and sometimes it's the end of the day. It's very difficult to pinned down. So if I show it earlier, that's fine. As a rough scribble, I can do that. I mean, I draw it out like that for myself anyway, to the standard of being able to get an idea across.
Yeah.
So you make the figure recognizable.
Sure.
The idea has got to be plain.
Yeah.
And I have to do that in the process of drawing it anyway for myself. I just refine the drawing. And then ink it in, and then colour it in. And that's the way it works.
And then it's scanned and it goes off.
And then it's scanned, and then I see it when it's on screen.
And that's it.
Which is what I was doing just before.
Yeah. So, I mean, so if you're listening to the day-to-day program at 6 o'clock in the morning and you're leaving here at 7. It's a long day. It's a 13-hour day.
Yeah, I don't sort of... Yeah, but it's not a bad day, you know.
It's
not as intensive as a much shorter hours day teaching is.
Which we didn't touch on, but of course you did teach for...
I'm not talking about my sort of teaching. I'm talking about the sort of teaching where you've got 20 children that you, youths and girls.
Not necessarily wanting to be there.
No, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that must be bloody hell. Compared to what I do. The only angst I get probably of my own making and my own... And I find the whole thing of a deadline is totally and absolutely beneficial because without it, I wouldn't produce the drawing.
Yeah.
And it has its own peculiar rhythm because, you know that by 2 or 3 o'clock... Although you've got to be very careful of it because if you start saying to yourself, well, I'm going to come up with something... You probably wouldn't, you know. You can't be complacent. You just have to just hope that the system works until you get Alzheimer's or whatever it is.
So I guess when you've got that idea down and you've basically got the structure together, and then you've got that nice run home with colouring in, you can probably turn on the radio and just coast a little.
No, I don't. You see, I absolutely love music. My music's one of my passions, and I can't listen to it while I'm working.
Music.
Yeah, I've got a radio here.
Yeah, I noticed.
But that's only for...
Just the news.
For news when I don't, watch it on television. I don't often listen to radio during the day. I do when I'm at home or when I'm, off work. But and music, as I say, I would have on... I used to listen to it a lot when I was illustrating and spending hours and hours and hours doing... Silly detailed gouache paint, not silly because I love doing them at the time. Well, I love doing them at the time, but when you consider, the amount of effort that went into a minimal amount of work in the end, that's the only silliness to me now. But no, I would listen to stuff then, but now I can't do it because you just need to be able to. So if I got listening to some string quartet or something, was trying to work. I'd be doing two things.
Yes.
And
when you're not doing this daily grind, which I know you've said it's a great thing to do. Let's face it. I mean, when you think of all the dreadful things one could be doing in the world, is a very privileged job.
It is. It's an incredibly privileged job because what you're doing basically is sounding off.
Yeah.
And being paid for it.
Absolutely.
And being given a space to do what you want.
With an enormous readership, which is...
You've got all of that. The only thing I do think about it is that compared to... I mean, just talking about the paper, compared to, so many foreign correspondents, for example, people out in Afghanistan doing that sort of stuff in Iraq. I mean, what I do is absolute, sort of... meaningless, basically. I mean, it's meaningful to me, and it's meaningful to people who
I think it is
who look at a newspaper.
Provocative and
but in the end, they're the ones who actually do the hard work. I mean, I don't consider what I do apart from the length of the day, I suppose, and sometimes the agony of trying to get an idea out of nothing or trying to make an idea work, all of that sort of thing, which are just personal things. If I were better, I wouldn't have that problem on occasions or things like that. So I don't consider it, as hard work or as valuable work as nursing or any of those things, really, at all. It does humble you that sort of thing because I'm having a great time, being well paid for it. The last editor said, "He said, you come again. Why do I have to indulge your prejudices every day?" which is basically that sums it up.
So, are there any other areas? It seems to me that you're very much locked into this world now, but this is your life. Do you ever see yourself sort of deviating out and maybe producing some more books? I mean, you've obviously produced books based very much on...
Yeah,
well,
there are only collections of what I've already done. I haven't done any specific work for books, apart from things I've illustrated for Folio Society or various little bits and bobs, I think.
So what do you do to...
I remember doing a couple of pages for one or two of your books, actually, yes, I seem to remember.
Absolutely, yes.
In times past.
A long time ago.
Yeah.
Too long ago to remember.
And but no. This will see me out, I think. And although God knows what I would do if I didn't do it. And the idea of retirement, to me, is just total anathema.
What generally happens with political cartoonists? That they just
fade away? The great thing about doing this sort of work is that very, very often, a bit like conductors, you know, they go on and on. You know,
yeah.
People like Trog, he was well into his 80s when he retired.
And Von Karajan, I mean, he was...
great drawer. One of the great cartoonists. Great German cartoonist. The thing about Trog, he only stopped when his eyesight started to fail. And there's been so many cartoonists who sort of go... I mean, Scarf is now into his 70s, I think.
I interviewed Scarf for one of these two.
Right.
Very fascinating.
So, and he'll be going on for
just
as long
works
as,
away.
Yeah, yeah.
Just.
Yeah, well, it's easy when you only do one a week, of course.
Well, I guess eventually maybe you can wind down to one.
Do you know,
a week.
I used to do, I did do a weekly for a while, I was, the Sunday Telegraph wanted me to stop working here and do a weekly. I've been there, weekly cartoon. I can't imagine anything worse, really. First of all, everyone else has got there before you during the week.
Yeah, of course.
And so, but you take no notice of that, I'm sure that doesn't matter. But, you know, you haven't got the next day to rely on to put right what you fucked up the day before.
Sure.
You know, that happens all the time.
Yeah.
You know, you have this thought that, I mean, you don't rely on it, otherwise you'd never do anything that was even half decent. But that's the great thing, is that the next day can, you know, put right what you didn't do so well the previous day. And the most often asked question I get is, do you ever run out of ideas? I mean, that's over the years the one thing that people say to you. And my stock reply is a bit of a cliche, but it's true, is that, no, you never run out of ideas. It's just that some, at the end of the day, you wish you hadn't come up with,
sure,
and landed with.
Yeah.
And that's why the next day sort of puts it right, in a way. And, you know, I remember reading, I think it was Stedman, saying that, you know, daily political cartoon is a sort of hellish thing to do. I mean, a ridiculous and worthless thing to do, because it becomes a habit. Well, it doesn't really. It's no more of a habit than when you read the paper and you say to whoever, you know, you're having breakfast with, in my case, my wife, you know, God, this is stupid, or that's stupid, or bloody hell, you know, how dare they, or, you know, it's no different than that.
No.
It's no different than just wanting to say something about any given thing every day and having the sort of space to do it in and being paid for it, which is the bonus.
Well, let's just round off now. A question that I've asked many designers is, you know, there are lots of budding young designers and illustrators too, and your world, the world of political, is a very small world actually.
Yeah,
it's quite a tight knit little world, and I'm sure it's quite a difficult thing to get into. I'm sure that, you know, a lot would go via magazines like Viz and those or just submitting.
Yeah.
There have been so many illustrators that their history is just freely submitting to magazines in order to get recognised, and so they do.
Yeah.
But anyway, what sort of advice would you give to any budding young illustrator who wanted to graduate towards political cartooning? What's the best thing for them to do?
What, in terms of actually getting into
that area? Yes.
Just ring up and ask if he... Because I never get... I mean, David Driver is the head of design, and he doesn't get that many political illustrators.
No, I think...
Political cartoonists. One, I mean, it's a strange... It's not like illustration, is it? I mean, for all the reasons that we've already talked about.
Yeah.
But people don't want to do it. Because
I think
actually,
they're frightened.
Exactly. It is tough, and my own sort of reticence about it, sort of,
points that out.
It's something that you're not trained to do. There's no College of Political Cartooning. There may well be correspondence courses, although I don't think they do those sort of things anymore, do they? But they just don't happen very often. In fact, the last person who wanted to go around showing work and to get comments from, you know, people already doing it was the guy who now does the days I don't do and is employed here. Not as a holiday relief at all. He's much better than that. Mm. He is someone that I'm scared stiff of because he's waiting to step into my shoes. Morton Moreland, who's very, very good. He's unique in terms of my experience of actually seeing anybody who does it. Anyway, he came to see me, showed me his stuff. I said to David, you ought to see this guy because, you know, he really is good. And he was pretty well hired on the spot.
Wow, that's extraordinary.
But that is, I tell you, he is a rarity in terms of... I used to get a lot more stuff through the mail about, you know, sometimes there were... The people who want to do it sort of quite often draw in exactly the same way. It's awful. It's strange. I can't describe it, but it's... they have an idea of what... And quite often they're sort of, I don't know, graduates from, you know, good universities who feel that they can... make a living as a cartoonist because they've got, you know, political leanings, or they've got, but their drawing is so generally awful, and there's nothing much you can do about that. But in terms of advice, but I don't get many of those now. Even I used to get more, and the paper just doesn't seem to hear from people like that anymore, and well, certainly not young people.
No.
Well, that's they're mostly alienated from it all, you know.
In a way, that's good for you.
It's fine.
Let's try and keep them away. Slots into your space when you're away is kept in the wings for a long time. Peter Brooks, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.